Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network.
And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight we'll go back in time to seasons past, when 22 men graced the rugged fields of yesterday, fighting for one more first down, one more yard gain, one final score that would bring victory after 60 minutes of battle on the gridiron. Tonight, we'll explore the world of gridiron greats. Welcome to Gridiron Greats Football History and its Memorabilia on the Gridiron Greats Publishing and Broadcasting Network. We're live from the Southport, North Carolina home of Gridiron Greats Magazine. I'm Bob Swick, publisher and editor of Gridiron Greats Magazine, and I'll be your host for the show. Gridiron Greats is the only publication in America that focuses upon the history and memorabilia of the North American football game since its inception in 1869. We cover 150-plus years of football history and memorabilia. You can find us on the web at GridironGreatsMagazine.com. It is at this time I'd like to introduce my co-host. He's a senior contributing writer to Gridiron Greats Magazine, a football memorabilia historian, specializing in pre-World War II items, in particular Red Grange, and also Seattle Seahawk items, in particular Steve Largent.
Yep.
He hails from Portland, Oregon, Mr. Joe Squires. Joe, welcome to the show this evening.
Captain, it's so good to be back. That's me, Steve Largent, Red Grange. You nailed it. The opposite ends of the hobby spectrum.
It's iconic in the beginning history of the game toward the more advanced modern game. It's very unique,
definitely,
to say the least.
Yeah.
But I want to lead off tonight.
NFL historians wrap it up around 89 when Largent retired. Yeah, I would agree with you.
I want to lead off tonight. Some incredible wax was auctioned off over the past 2 weeks. And a rumor has it, my co-host was able to obtain a few packs. So I'm going to hand off to you, and let's go forward with this.
I've mentioned I've been getting back into unopened wax a little bit. I've drifted and drifted away and come back, and it's such a nostalgic part of the hobby for me. And we had two big auctions ending over the weekend, one of them Robert Edward Auctions, REA. Brian Dwyer, the president of REA, was on the Gridiron Greats podcast, what, about 6 months ago, Bob?
Correct.
I think so.
Yep.
Obviously a very successful auction this go due to the gridiron bump, we might add. But tip of the hat, just a really good, a 52 tops wax pack baseball sold for 87,000 plus the 20%. So what would that be? It'd be $100,000 for a nickel pack from 1952.
If you could go back and the record, got to be the record for any pack in baseball. That's my gut feeling. I don't think anything broke 100,000. I'm not sure though.
I'd be very curious. Is there
$100,000? Yeah, I got to do some research.
58 Topps sellout PSA 7 sold for $9,600. That includes the buyer's premium. I did the math. And 58 sellout always tends to be in that 6 to 8 range. So, you know, pretty cool to see that going strong. I haven't seen a 58 Topps wax pack sell in a while. There was an ungraded one on eBay about a month ago. 57 Topps football nickel pack, twin baloney, sold for about $4,000, which is in the range. 1960 Fleer, but the one I really wanted to draw a note to, which is the one I mentioned on VFC, was 1967 Philly football wax pack. Yes, graded PSA 9, which is pretty high, but it sold for $9,250. So throw in another $1,800 buyer's premium, you're looking at $11,000 for a nickel pack. That's 2 years older than me.
And that I do not understand in any way, shape, or form why that pack went as high as it did. I mean, I opened 65, 66, 67 Philly when I was a kid. Those were nickel packs. I don't know who would be in the pack to drive it, number one, but number two, even though it's PSA 9, I just can't comprehend why that pack went as high as it did, but it did.
A 64 Philly, a 64 Philly nickel pack graded PSA 9, 3 years older than that one, went for $1,750, or about $2,200, including a buyer's premium.
Yeah,
so
I don't
a fourth. Yeah.
I really don't get it. I got a feeling whoever was after the 67 Philly pack either needed it for a run that he was completing of wax packs in higher grade, or was trying to get the last Philly pack for his run. I honestly don't know. I can't comprehend why that went as high as it did. It's an incredible sign for the hobby. Don't get me wrong. But I just don't get it. I truly don't get it.
Yeah.
So,
some good runs. 55 Bowman nickel pack, PSA 6, went for $2,500, including the buyer's premium. Just some good prices. A first series unopened wax box, 1972 Topps first series, 24 packs sealed, went for $9,600. 26 packs you're talking about. Or 24 packs, divided by $9,600. $300 a pack. That's pretty good. Just good, all in all, good, strong prices for wax packs. I mean, heck, I get down into my alma mater, but 1979 Topps, a PSA 8, 1979 Topps pack, which would be a quarter, went for $225. So throw in another $25, so it's $250. Imagine that.
Unbelievable. That's truly unbelievable.
Maybe some of this is how long it takes to get a pack graded nowadays. So, I mean, even for me, I don't look at a pack as going, oh, that's a nickel, you know, and, you know, I don't take, a 79 Topps box and say I can get that for 2,500 divided by 36. Okay, a pack's about 60 or 70 bucks, and then it costs 25 to get graded. You don't really think like that anymore. Now you think, it's $30 and it's going to take me 9 to 12 months to get. So I think you nailed it up above where it's like somebody wanted to complete the run now and they didn't want to wait.
Right. I look at the 79 wax pack there. And again, to date myself, what I talk about in my day and what I saw can't be comprehended by a lot of people today because they don't believe that at one time in the early 80s, you could buy a 1979 wax box on a clearance a year or two later for $5 or $10 a box.
Yeah.
And a lot of collectors were very hesitant to buy it because what are they going to do with it other than open it and put cart, you know, and try to make another set or whatever type of thing. Anyone who had foresight and bought it and just put it away obviously was able to get an incredible rate of return on their investment. But at the same time, whoever had the foresight back then to say, okay, this is in limited quantity. Not every 1979 Topps wax box was saved. Therefore, how many were actually saved over the years? Obviously, late 70s, 80s, And 90s wax boxes were much more saved than the 60s or the 70s ones, the early 70s
totally.
Ones. But still, at,
totally
still at the same time, I mean, I can't comprehend what's going on with it, you know. But you're correct in what you're saying. It's probably the PSA grade bump that everybody's looking at right now, that it's a lot cheaper to buy an already made, already graded pack than to try to buy it and then try to get it graded somewhere, you know.
And it's a two-step process to get a pack graded. It's got to go to PSA. They got to box it to ship it to Steve Hart at BBCE.
Right.
Obviously, Steve Hart's business is doing well because of him being on the podcast, the Gridiron Bump, this year. So it's nice to see Steve's business get a, you know, the Gridiron Bump. But it's got to go to PSA. It's got to get boxed up. It's got to get cataloged. It's got to get sent to Steve Hart. He's got to grade it or tell them what the number is. The grade number, authenticate it, mail it back to PSA, who's then got to slab it and then got to send it to you. I mean, that's a complicated process, and that's a lot of shipping, that's a lot of handling, that's a lot of getting jostled around.
Yep, I agree, you know, I agree. But again, I don't know, I can't see in a way, I do see in a way and I don't see in a way, you got a graded pack of cards. So basically, the only way you're going to open it, if you really want to open those cards, you got to break open the pack. You got to, you know, unseal it. Then you got to open the pack itself, and then you got to see what cards you got in there, and that's it. So it's an amazing game in a way, but also I understand a unopened wax pack collection, because I used to have one, unopened wax packs from 1975 to the current year until I sold them off. But I never thought, in any way, shape, or form to get them graded. You know what I mean? And I can still remember one of our dinners years ago at a national, I brought a 76 wax pack with me. I opened it, and it was a bunch of commons. There was nobody there. Nobody in the pack that was really of any value. If I had gotten it graded, you know, been the pandemonium over a Peyton rookie, and would have driven the price of it accordingly at the same time. It's amazing. It's amazing area.
I wonder what
this is going to
do for the unopened market, because if a wax pack, because, you know, you can buy a, let's just use a, you know, a 79 that we were just talking about. So you can buy a box, a BBC sealed box of 79 tops for about $2,500. Well, if a pack is worth $250, and there's 36 of them in there, that's $9,000. So you really, there's, you know, the sum of the components, you know, formula from business school here. You buy a BBCE sealed verified box with 36 packs, you send it to PSA and say, please open this box and grade all 36 packs. They send you 36 packs. Sure. You put them up on eBay for the fire sale of 200 each. Well, that's $7,200. You just made $5,000 less grading fees, obviously. But are we going to start seeing a lot more of that? Or you can break it up?
I would sense that may be happening in the long run. And again, if PSA has lesser waiting times, it would be more prevalent. But I think, you know, like you said originally, if it's 9 to 12 months to get it graded, this is a long-term project that you're going to tie up, let's say, $5,000-$6,000 worth of your investing. Is it really worth doing it, type of thing? I really don't know. I honestly don't know. Again, the hobby goes in so many different ways and so many different, for lack of a better term, fads. Is this a passing fad, or is this the real thing that we're going to see? Are we going to see $200 to $300, $400 packs from the early 80s into the 70s? Is it going to be maintained down the road, or is it, you know, just another bubble that's happening in the hobby? I don't know. I really don't know. I can't. I don't have a good handle and grip on this. The only thing I'm going to argue is that, there is a limited amount of product in the market. There's a limited amount of true unopened material in the market. You know that as well as I do. So that's going to impact the market down the road, and that will impact the prices in the market at the same time. So it's so much of this,
but I'm having a good time. I bought another wax box, And you're going to laugh at this. In my office, I've mentioned I have uncut sheets, that I've framed and hung on the wall. And as I've been buying wax boxes, I've been kind of putting them in weird spots, like hanging them on it, putting them on a shelf in my office. And about 3-4 weeks ago, I saw, somebody had wax packs, displayed in a, in a glass case hanging on the wall. I'm like, that's kind of cool. And then I came across a couple wax packs, and I bought them. And I'm in the hunt looking for a glass display that'll carry it. So I'm going to have to reach out to some people who have that display. Because most of them are for a PSA card, but the wax packs are a little bit taller. Mm-hmm. I decided to start a run of graded wax packs and then put them in a little glass display in my office hanging on the wall. I'm really, really enjoying the nostalgia of the hobby and buying stuff that I was used to as a kid and putting it on a wall. I mean, it just when people come into my office, they're like, that's kind of cool. It's just, it's not just, and I'm really enjoying it because years ago I used to put this stuff, in a closet because I was afraid it'd get damaged or stolen. Or something, and now I just kind of like, I'm gonna enjoy this stuff every damn day, and I love it.
Right, that's great, and that's what the hobby is about. I mean, to actually display things, look at things, view things, and again, a lot of memories that you have from your childhood, and I can always say this, if push came to shove and I liquidated everything that I had, I probably would never liquidate my 1960 to 1969 sets, memorabilia, publications, so on and so forth, because that's the hobby for me. That's my greatest memory is that 10-year period. More so the years 65 to 68, which were my, literally the childhood memories of going and buying packs, buying sports magazines, and so on and so forth.
Yep.
And that's the greatest part of the hobby is, you're remembering your youth in a lot of cases. And it's what it's all about at the same time. But I can see now what a longtime rapper collector told me back in the 1980s. Mike Richardson was an incredible collector of sports card rappers of all sports and display boxes.
Oh, wow.
And he said to me, it has to have been probably 86, 87, I started corresponding with him, and he says at some point you'll grow tired of cards and you'll want to start collecting the wrappers and the display boxes. And I had said to I still had a lot of wrappers that I had collected over the years from actually when I bought the packs, and I put them away. It would, somehow saved one of them a couple of years back, later 70s, early 80s. I'd open up a wax box. I saved all the wrappers, so on and so forth. So long story short, I traded a bunch of stuff with him for wrappers I needed, so on and so forth. And when he said that to me at that time, I really didn't put a lot of thought into it. But, looking back at it now, almost 40 years later, it's incredible to think, there aren't a lot of wrapper and display box collectors out there or unopened wax pack collectors out there. For a variety of reasons, too difficult to collect, and B, the cost, it becomes cost prohibitive now, especially now with graded wrapper, wax packs and the like.
Packs,
you're
absolutely right.
It's an incredible part of our hobby. It really is. It's very, 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 very interesting, very, very distinct to say the least. So,
I'm happily getting back, slowly dipping my toe back into the wax pack, part of the hobby, and I'm enjoying it. I'm digging it.
Good. It's a great collection. I mean, it's really fun to look at. And again, your case, you bought a lot of the late 70s, early 80s stuff. That's your childhood memory. So that's what it's all about. At the same time.
Yep.
All right, our special guest is here. I'd like to introduce him and get on with our next segment of our program. Our special guest tonight currently resides in Edmond, Oklahoma, with his wife and three children. He's worked in local government for nearly a decade after spending a decade working in college sports. His hobbies include collecting antique football memorabilia, travel, and attending and watching sporting events and serving in the community. I'd like to welcome to our show this evening, Mr. Casey Moore. Casey, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Bob. Thank you, Joe. It's really a pleasure to join you.
Outstanding. Thank you.
Thanks for being on. And I'm going to lead off, Casey, by asking you, how did you get started in collecting football artwork and football memorabilia?
Well, it's kind of funny. It's a long circle, it feels like. But like everyone else, I started collecting cards when I was a kid, and it was fun listening to you guys talk about opening and buying all the unopened stuff. I very much remember the first cards I bought were 1986 Topps football, and
Wow.
Still have some of those in the collection. They are rough, but they have a special bond. And then I got hooked just in time for the junk wax era. So I worked in a card shop as a kid for a little bit, and blew every penny that they gave me on cards. And then like most everyone else, got to my teen years, and it all went away, and I got interested in other things. But really, the seeds of collecting football art and memorabilia really started when I was in college. I kind of reintroduced myself to the hobby. The biggest factor for me was in grad school. I was getting a master's degree at Wichita State in sport administration. And I had a class where I got to do an independent study, and I had to do some, essentially, for a lack of a better term, book reports. And one book that I did was a book called For Pride, Profit, and Patriarchy. And it talked about the early days of football, especially college football. And I just got hooked on the history, and I devoured that book, just the stories that I was reading. And so then, of course, I want to start looking these people up, and I end up on eBay, and I'm like, oh, look, I can buy this and this and this. And as I started doing that, I really gravitated kind of to some lower end stuff, because I was in college, didn't have a whole lot of money, and I think I figured out pretty quick that I liked the artwork on things. So the T-51 Murads were some of the first things that I bought, specifically the football cards. And then there's a handful of postcards from that same era, really kind of 1910 to 1920. I spent years and years collecting those things, and mainly because I didn't have a lot of room to display anything. In the last few years, I don't have a man cave like I've seen so many great people that have. But in the last few years, my wife has been kind enough to allow me to start to have a place to put some things. So I started buying bigger things. And man, I'm hooked at this point, and collecting really a lot of display pieces, posters. It's kind of called the golden age of illustration. So there's a handful of artists that I collect of these college posters, and they're beautiful. They're very rare, especially compared to card population. So that's my number one thing that I'm looking at right now, and it's hard to find, but the hunt is really fun.
Yeah.
Wow.
So I can just hear the passion in your voice. Yeah, I love that. Man, thanks for coming on, Casey. I appreciate it. And thank you really for sending over those pictures I asked for. You know, when we start talking about people's pride and joy, their baby, their collection, it's always fun to just see the collection in its natural habitat, I guess. And
sure.
I absolutely loved the display case, you know, the tall cabinet you sent over with some of the cards, like it looks like the Murads, and
some of the larger ones are in there. Yes.
Yeah. Just incredible. I mean, just and love it. Just you have a passionate, a passion for your collection. Obviously you live, the home of Bright Path, where Jim Thorpe. So you're in, you're definitely in football territory. Tell our audience, a few things about your artwork, your Thorpe collections, your Olympic collections, stuff like that. Just some of the stuff you sent pictures over of.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. You nailed it right on the head. In fact, Edmond is less than an hour away from Yale, Oklahoma, the birthplace of Jim Thorpe. And so you grow up in the state, and everyone knows who Jim Thorpe is, and knows the history and the stories. And so, yeah, that's one of the first things when you start thinking, I'm going to collect antique football stuff and memorabilia and cards. Well, if you're from here, you start looking for Thorpe items. For me, you know, again, I never knew this about myself. I love the history, and I will spend so much time researching everything. But when it comes to looking at the collection and enjoying it, like you were talking about earlier, and putting things on display, I love the artwork. And so I collect kind of ancillary and obscure Thorpe items, more foreign type pieces. And a lot of the best stuff is kind of built around his 1912 Olympics triumphs. And so, you know, there is a fair amount of football stuff out there and baseball stuff out there. And I have some of those in my collection, but some of the stuff that I really enjoy, it revolves around, you know, his, obviously he had such a worldwide reach and this huge thing when he became the greatest athlete in the world in 1912. So there were things that were being produced, you know, for years and years after that, that recognized his achievements. So probably the neatest Thorpe item that I have is a print from a 1912 French magazine. I don't have it up on display because I can't bring myself to remove it from the magazine. I can't destroy something. So it's a cool item that I wish I had on display and I could look at all the time, but I can't bring myself to take the magazine apart. And then I've just got a bunch of random items like that make me happy and, you know, aren't the most expensive Thorpe items. I'd love to have some of those. And I've got a few on my want list someday. But I just like to find things that are unique and you know, are fun to look at.
Good for you. Good for you. That's the way it should be, man. I like it.
Yeah. And then, you know, you'd mentioned also the posters. That's what I'm really into more than anything. And those college posters are hard to find, and they display beautifully. And thankfully, my wife likes them because I'm maybe the only person in the world that his wife allows him to display his collection in the master bedroom. So,
Wow.
So we've kind of, all those pictures I sent you are in our master bedroom. She kind of said, "Yeah, we can have like an early 1900s dorm room feel." I said, "Sure, let's do it." And I was beyond excited.
I did see a mirror that's cool on that wall, so yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. So that's something that you won't find in most homes in America.
That's pretty cool. Huh.
That's cool.
All right, now I'm looking for the intimate stuff here in the picture. I'm looking for the – yeah, you cropped out the nightstand stuff, so good job. Well done.
Yeah, I made sure to focus on the collection. Absolutely, Joe.
Yeah, you don't want to make that mistake with me. I'll run with
exactly.
It.
Casey, I know you got so much stuff in your collection, and looking at those photos of the items, I mean, they're just some great items. Can you narrow down for our audience what you consider to be your top five items in your collection, and if you can describe them to our audience at the same time?
Oh, five items, sure. You know, the nice thing about, you know, what I wouldn't say the nice thing, the exciting thing about collecting these display items is, you know, you feel like it's such a victory when you actually win something because they're so hard to find.
Yeah.
And then when you do find them, there's not a lot of people that collect them, but they're neat. And so people will bid on them and actually number one, I'm going to say it because even though I don't have it in hand yet, I just bought three posters by an artist named Bristow Adams. And these are the college posters that really grabbed me and pulled me into this part of the hobby. And to be honest, I've come up short on them many times over the years. And so this last weekend, I just happened upon an auction at the right time and reached out and got the deal done. And I'm waiting. They're supposed to be here tomorrow. So you didn't even see them in the pictures yet, but, We got three of these posters. Two are football, one is track and field. And I've done research on these things for 20 years, and I'm pretty sure I'm the only person that's psychotic enough to have a database of all these and image examples of almost all of them. So I know what I'm looking for. So I've got three coming in tomorrow. One is West Point, one is Annapolis, both are football, and then Harvard track and field. And they're just incredibly tough to find. You all know.
Where'd you find them?
Auden. There was an eBay find. Got on at the right time.
Nice.
Made the right offer, and I'm still holding my breath, waiting for him to show up tomorrow. So, you all know Scotty Auden, who's a very advanced Army West Point collector, and he got the West Point poster last year, and it had been number one on his want list for years and years. And so these things are tough; they're tough to find. So that's number one on my list. Number two, I've got a great poster by an artist named Hibbard Klein. He did a series of posters, football. There's a handful of football, and then there's some baseball, there's rowing and some others, 1910, 1911. I've got one. That's real high on my list. I'd love to find more. This one is titled Clear. It's 22 by 28. So it's a really big poster. It's just beautiful art. And so that's number two. That would have been number one. If you would have asked me before I made this purchase last week. Number three, I've got a big poster, 22 by 28 by J.C. Leyendecker, who's a very famous artist and very, very highly sought after. It's a poster that also hangs there in the room and displays really well. Number four, I've got a what's called a yard print. These are all college posters. This one's called a yard print. It hangs above the bed. So it's almost 4 feet long. It's by an artist, Moses Blumenthal, and also from 1910 era, 1909, I believe, for this poster. And it's a scene of a coach kind of getting after his team in the locker room, and it's a glimpse into what halftime might have looked like 110 years ago. And the colors on
that was labeled
beautiful.
End of the first half, no score, giving them blank. And what I love is there's a dude laying on the ground, you know, in the locker room, and I'm like, that's a good one.
Yeah, it's just a neat piece. And then I've got a couple of paintings actually that not by famous artists, but are paintings. What's interesting is they're paintings of art that are done by famous artists. So one is from a piece of art that John Sheridan, who's one of these artists of the same era, did for a magazine called Sunset, and it's two Stanford players. Somebody painted this probably, I'm guessing, in the 30s, based upon the frame that it came in, and it's a fantastic reproduction. And so I've got that painting. It's a 16 by 20, and then recently I got another painting. It's a guy punting a ball. He's in what I think is probably the Chicago Maroons uniform, and that is actually a reproduction of a Leyendecker painting that he had done earlier. So those, I mean, I've got lots of other items that are great. I've got items, you know, they're smaller, but I'm so into the display pieces. Those are what I would call my top five.
Which one of those is your favorite? I'm fanning back and forth, and I'm just
You cut out. I didn't hear that.
Go ahead, Bob.
I just got a quick question, a little off script. On your posters, how difficult and/or how easy is it to frame them? And do you feel like a limit as far as what you're going to frame and what you won't frame because of the age of it? I'm just curious about that.
Sure. No, absolutely. Honestly, what I have found is a lot of the time, they come in period frames. The ones that I'm finding, they're already framed. And so typically what I will do is when I get those, I will take them apart. I'll take them out of the frame. I'll try to, if there's anything that needs to be cleaned up or anything that looks like it could could possibly damage the poster. I'll try to fix that. I'll make sure and remove anything. You know, a lot of these things come with cardboard backing, which is terrible for posters because of the acid. So I'll remove that, put an acid-free backing on everything, try to protect it. And then if it comes in a frame, I love leaving it in the frame. So I'll, you know, do everything I need to do, frame it back up and hang it on the wall as is. Otherwise, you know, they can come in varying degrees of disarray and condition, just like cards can, but they can definitely be fragile depending on what sort of life they've lived. But putting them in a frame in a proper frame is definitely much better for them than any other way to have them. And so, you know, we don't have any UV rays coming into our bedroom. It's all LED lighting, and so that's a good thing for them too.
I mean, I'm looking at these. I'm like, these are all so colorful and so old school cool.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I'm like, God, I dig them. I love the collage. You have like 10 of them on one wall, you know, with like outing and two guys crouching. But I mean, by a poster says down. But I think my favorite is there's a guy wearing a red jersey kicking a football, and there's a C on the jersey. I think I like that just because it looks like a Carlisle jersey.
Mm-hmm. That's the one that I said I thought maybe was Chicago, but absolutely it could be Carlisle. And that one is a painting. That's a painting. It's a reproduction of something that J.C. Leyendecker had done that is a little bit more famous. It was used on the cover of a magazine, but it's really neat. In fact, that's one that I haven't had that long, and so that's one of my newer additions to the collection.
Oh, cool. Right on. So you mentioned in your bio when you emailed it over, you know, that you work in local government. So immediately my mind went to Parks and Rec, and I imagine none of it's wrong. You know, Ron Swanson taking a sip of Lagavulin 16, and I'm like, all right, well, the guy collects football cards, works in local government, he's got to be Ron Swanson. So
I don't have the awesome mustache, but I would love to be Ron Swanson.
Wouldn't we all? Actually, you know, when I was watching that, I was just always thinking of Bob, you know, with the mustache and just that demeanor where it's just, you know, give or take it, you know. But just, you know, what you collect, just where you live. I mean, just you've got to have some stories, just because, I mean, being in Oklahoma, you know, the hot seat of, you know, Jim Thorpe. Like you said, everybody knows who that is. The stuff come out of the woodworks. Are you more privy to, you know, good Thorpe stuff? Just what are some stories you can share?
Well, what's funny is, I feel like it's actually the opposite. And I think part of that has to do with just the age of our state. You know, we're a newer state in comparison to a lot of others. And so I have a hard time finding, especially the really old stuff. It's hard to find around here. So, you know, a lot of my best collecting stories, since you can't really find a lot of things around here, antique stores is kind of where I have a lot of luck. And eBay, those are the places where I quote unquote find things. And you know, the way that I think about it is you can still find things on eBay. You can still find things in antique stores, you know, where once they make it to the advanced collectors, the dealers, the specialty auctions, then at that point, in my opinion, that those items have been found, you know, if they were to sell, they're priced appropriately. But one really neat, there's one antique store that I've been in 100 times and a booth that I'd bought things out of before for, you know, not, I don't even think they were sports things. I think they were gifts for somebody else. And, you know, one of the things I've learned is when you're in an antique store, you want to find the junkiest booths possible as far as not the items, but how much stuff is in there. And then you want to start digging, because that's where you find the best things, kind of the items that have been forgotten. And so I just happened to look down, and there was like a banker's box, just a box on a bottom shelf. And I pulled it out. I had no idea what it was. And it was full of football equipment. And, I had a pair of shoulder pads in it, had some, and they weren't great. They're on display, but had some 1930s cleats, and then had a pair of 1900 to 1910 pants. And so that was a great find, and, you know, it was just sitting in a box and priced very, very attractively. And so that's kind of how I have to collect most of the time. I kind of dig through antique stores and have a million eBay searches saved and, you know, turn over every rock that I can. So it's, yeah, that's, now if you want to collect Oklahoma things and all that, yeah, you can find that if you're really into, you know, 40s, 50s and that sort of thing. But when you're trying to find turn of the century stuff, it's not real common around here. So you got to work pretty hard at it.
Boy, and that herd of people doing that Jim Thorpe search, you know, on eBay and all the various ways you can search it is pretty, mm-hmm. you're pretty good company.
Oh, I know for a fact. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Me included. I it's a weekly thing, but, you know, also kind of a, you know, I'm bored. Let me take a quick peek, but
yeah,
lately I'm distracting myself with football wax packs, but yeah, it's
keep doing that. Leave the Thorpe stuff for us.
I love it, but how cool is that? Just, I don't know, it's just, you know, yeah, West Coast envy, because, you know, nothing cool. There's no football history that, you know, starts with, well, in Portland, Oregon, you know, so. But,
I mean, there's some antique shops, a few places, I haven't been able to find anything. So, I'm sure you're going to go. One of all deep trap downtown Southport, and the guy, like you're saying, he's got access to the bottom of the shelf looking for it. It's a Life magazine, the clothes on it from the 50s. And I talked about it, and the guy, and I asked how much he wants for it, and he says, the clothes can. I said, well, I collect football. So he gave me the price that I paid him from, and I asked him, did he have football stuff? He says, he used a particular word for full of stuff. I'll start pulling some football stuff and bring it into the store. So pretty interesting. You know, you never know what you're going to find anywhere you go. It's simple.
Absolutely.
You know,
absolutely.
At least expect it, you'll find something. Mm. It's amazing. How can you tell if it's a piece of artwork that you're buying is real or a reproduction? Do you have any guide to go by?
I think like I said before, I've, at least the stuff that I collect, I've kind of been building a database over time. So it's really just for me, it's research, knowing the history of these college posters. Like they were printed in specific sizes. And so if something isn't sized right, you know that it's probably not going to be real. And there are a lot of reproductions, because a lot of these, the Library of Congress has scanned some of these in, and you can actually go in and you can print them out as reproductions. And so you kind of need to know the paper stock, the size, and then you can always look at the printing. You know, one of the things that people do, like they do with cards, is you look at the, you can kind of zoom in with a loop and look at the print dots and see if they are accurate with the error of printing. And so and then, you know, paintings are going to look like paintings. So it's what I collect. It's like anything else. I mean, you got to know what you're going to buy, especially if you're going to spend a lot of money on it, because you can get burned pretty easily. And I think at some point as collectors, we've all bought something that after we bought it, we're like, oh yeah, that wasn't what I thought it was. And hopefully you didn't take a bath on it.
I've also bought stuff and went, oh shoot, I should not have bought that. And then, you know, a year later, wow, I'm really glad I bought that. So,
yeah, I've done that. I've done that too.
I know a lot of people, you know, what's on your want list? I mean, and I know sometimes you don't know what you want until you see it. You're like, holy moly, I didn't even know that existed. I mean,
right.
Other than, you know, breaking into the coveted Steve Largent segment of the hobby, you know, what is on your want list?
Well, you know, Largent's an Oklahoma guy too. You haven't even, you keep talking about Thorpe, but you know, Largent, and I'll go off script for a real quick. You'll appreciate this, Joe. My 11-year-old son decided for who knows what reason to be a Seattle Seahawks fan. And so I am taking him, I'm surprising him this weekend. We're flying to Houston, and he's going to his first NFL game, and we're going to go see the Seattle Seahawks. So we will see their current iteration of Steve Largent, DK Metcalf. That is my son's favorite player.
I'm looking at a Steve Largent for governor bumper sticker hanging by my desk. And
he managed to goof that up, but that's another podcast.
That's a whole nother podcast. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He really missed it. Yeah. But
wow.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you'd asked about want list. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I've got a handful of things that, you know, I mentioned earlier. I've got a Hibbert Klein poster that I love. Hibbert Klein, he's got a few others that I would love to have. A couple of them that are also those 22x28. So I've got a couple of posters of his now, but I'd love to have more of those. Those are at the top. And then, you know, I mentioned the Bristow Adams posters before, and also John Sheridan, who was also part of that same series. Those anytime you can come across those, I want those for sure. Moses Blumenthal, who I mentioned, you know, I have the poster. He has another one called Touchdown, where there's a guy crossing the goal line as he's getting tackled, and that's a 22x28. It's a beautiful piece. So those are the big display things. I do have a few things on my want list. You know, I still do collect some small things. There's an obscure set of colleges called T49. And in that T49 set, there's one football card, and it's Yale. I had a chance many years ago to buy one that was in rough shape, and I didn't buy it at the time, and I regret it now because I don't know if I'll ever see another one again. So it's a pretty obscure tobacco set.
What was the set again?
T49. And it's Schultz Own Tobacco, T49. And it's a series of college scenes, and one of them has a Yale student holding a football, and it's a neat little card. So and then I've got a few Thorpes. I've got the Thorpe that's on every advanced Thorpe collector's list, that there's only one that anybody knows that exists. I know, Joe, you probably know what I'm talking about, right?
There's only one that exists?
Or one that's known to exist, the Capital Candy Jim Thorpe.
Sacramento.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah. 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 Amazing card.
I forgot about that.
Yeah.
The problem is I know the guy who owns it, and, you know, about once a year I do the obligatory, like, you know, hey, just seeing how things go and how's the fam, but in reality, just making sure he knows I'm out there, you know.
I'm assuming someday that may go to auction, and it's going to cost a fortune, but it's an amazing card, and I think we all kind of dream of going on eBay and finding the second one, so... So that one's on the list. There is there's an obscure cigar display of Jim Thorpe that I have a picture of. Don't know where I got that picture of it from. And it's from that same era of 1912. If I ever found one of those, that would be amazing. It's Ruskin Skookin cigar. There's also a postcard of the 1913 New York Giants. Down in Texas, and that one has Thorpe in it. And that's a postcard that I'd like to add to my collection. That's probably the most realistic one of the Thorpe items that I can find.
You just poured salt in the wound just thinking of that 1912 Sacramento card. And it's such a cool card.
It is.
It's not even a rookie card, really. I mean, there's, you know, you've got the, I don't know, you've got postcards, you've got, you know, I don't know. There's things prior to that, but just that one's special.
You know why? Because it's color. It's color, just like the artwork that I collect. Once you add color, it just makes it more beautiful.
Definitely an amazing card, to say the least. Well, who knows? I mean, you never know what's out there. So
that's right.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Casey.
Yeah. Now you just rekindled. I got to reach out to that guy again and see how he's doing.
Casey,
I feel so contrite when I do it. But, oh, well. Sorry, Bob.
You have any advice for a beginning collector in our hobby?
I would say three things. Have a broad knowledge and a narrow focus. Knowing about a lot of things and a lot of collectibles is great, because sometimes I buy items that I don't necessarily collect, but I know it's a good deal because I have a broad knowledge, and I can use that someday down the road for something that I do want. But by having a narrow focus, I don't end up with one of these things where my wife looks at me and goes, your collection's taking over our house. You're going to have to figure something out. So for me, I believe broad knowledge, narrow focus. Also don't go it alone. Honestly, I spent most of my time collecting just kind of on my own, doing my own thing. And it's been in more recent years that I've really started to kind of get to know people in the hobby, and I realized how much I missed out not enjoying the hobby with others. And so finding others that have similar passions, there's lots of groups that you can get involved in that you can share, and it's just a lot more fun that way. And then I think I mentioned this one earlier. If you really want it, buy it then, because you may never get another chance. So I have more stories of things that I haven't bought that I regret than things that I just jumped on. So that's something probably more recent. It's like, if you really want it, you need to buy it, because you may never get a chance again.
Yeah, I like that. What did you say? Broad knowledge, narrow focus is such a cool way to put it, because – very good way to put it. I like that.
It's interesting because you said broad knowledge, and that brings back in my mind one of my greatest learning experiences I had. This is back in the early 1990s. I worked for a small card shop in near where I lived in Connecticut, and the name of the store was Collectible Investments. And he just didn't have cards, sports cards. He had everything. He had Star Wars toys. He had other toys and original boxes. He had stamps. He had coins. He had political items. He had a lot of paper items and a lot of what amounted to be very rare paper items that he would sell at a show in Hartford, Connecticut, which was called Paper Mania. And long story short, he talked stuff about a lot of different areas of different hobbies and different collections. And you're right, you can buy something that isn't in your collection, but you can make a really good buy, turn it over, and take that same money and put it into your collection. And that's something I learned a long time ago, and it's very interesting to me. And it's interesting to see other things, too, at the same time.
Yeah.
As far as other collectibles or other items.
Nice. I like it. Broad knowledge. And you're right. I mean, think about all this stuff that we, know about, that are familiar with. I mean, how many times are you at a party or, a friend says, hey, what do you think of, these, baseball cards, or whatever. And it's just, we know about them. Yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I can tell you what years these baseball cards are from, and I can tell you who the best players are, and hey, you want high numbers and this and that. But do I collect any of it? No. But it pays to know that stuff. It definitely does.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the more knowledge anyone has in any hobby, and the more general knowledge you have, the more historical knowledge you have, so on and so forth, it's very, very helpful in collecting. And that's a very good point that you brought up. And I'm glad you did, because it's kind of overlooked in our hobby to a large degree, because people tend to be very over specialized in things, and then they miss out on a lot of other things. So that's a good point. I like it. Casey, any other final thoughts?
No. This has been fun. I really appreciate you guys having me on. You know, like I said just a minute ago, I went it alone for a long time, just kind of in thinking I would enjoy the hobby more by myself, but as I get to know more great people like you all, it makes the hobby a lot more fun. So I really appreciate the opportunity to spend some time with you.
Well, thank you for being on, Casey. And like I said, I've over the years have seen and talked to people with some incredible collections, and it truly astounds me to see what people have in their collections. And I truly thank you for sharing it with our audience tonight. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you, guys.
Thank you for coming on.
We're going into our two-minute warning. I'm going to hand off to you. Would you pick up on tonight's show?
That son of a bitch better not out-ace me on any Jim Thorpe stuff on eBay. Another Jim Thorpe collector. I was going to ask him what keywords he was, you know, looks for, but I just Jim Thorpe or Kent Bulldogs or, you know, I've got like three, I think, and it gets a little tedious sometimes. And then I stop and I go, man, I can think of four or five people who are out there trying to outgun me every day on it, you know, and it's funny.
For
how bad would you feel if, you know, if you did a search and like, hey, recently ended, check out this 1912 Sacramento. You know, some guy named Jeff Payne bought it for, you know, $450 because nobody knew what it was.
Right.
And then I have to bite my tongue. You know, Jeff posted up bragging about it. You're just like, damn it, that should have been mine.
Well, that's, again, it all goes to show, you know, you got to spend the time, which you do anyways, you know, looking for stuff, and you got to be knowledgeable about what you're looking at. And it's amazing to me. eBay still presents, you know, I call it the wild, wild west out there, because you never know what you're going to see on there. You never know, in a lot of cases, if it's legitimate or not legitimate. And you don't know who you're up against trying to bid on something with it. So it's pretty amazing to see. And again, eBay's evolved very dramatically over the years anyways. To me, it's more of a fixed price buy it now type of website rather than the true auction house that it started out to being, you know, many, many years ago. So it's pretty interesting to see. But Casey's got a great, great collection, and I enjoyed hearing about the artwork, which is, I think, kind of overlooked in our hobby, to say the least.
Totally.
People collect many different specific things, basically cards, publications, and the like, but he's into the artwork, and I think that's pretty cool and pretty neat.
Yeah. The pictures he sent over of his artwork were really cool. It was very nice.
It is. They were beautiful, beautiful pieces. All right, we're almost we're running out of time. If you're not a subscriber to Gridiron Greats Magazine, what are you waiting for? Check out our website, gridirongreatsmagazine.com. And just a quick plug for the rest of the month with our shows, our 75th issue will be coming out in January. We're going to have it out the middle of the month, so it's going to be very interesting. A lot of our theme of 75 will be prevalent in that issue. All right, final thoughts, 30 seconds, Joe. Hand it off to you one more time.
Outstanding. I love seeing other people's collections and things they're passionate about and, you know, narrowly focused. Love it. Thanks for being a guest, Casey. That was a good show.
Yeah, it's great. I enjoyed a very, very different view of a collection tonight, and it's pretty cool. And I love those pictures he sent to us. All right, we're almost out of time. Thanks for being on. We'll be back hopefully next week with another show. And until that time, we'll see you then. Thanks for listening.
Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
Do you wish you knew more about the 100 seasons of the NFL? You're in luck because you found the Football History Dude podcast, where each episode is a journey back in time to learn about the rich history of the NFL. From the founding of the league in an auto showroom, all the way to what it is today, America's favorite sport and a behemoth of an industry. My name is Ernie Chapman. Football is my passion, and I want you to come along with me each week to explore the yesteryear of the gridiron. So hop on board my DeLorean, and let's get this baby up to 88 miles per hour.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.